Yeah, Mark said it would be a short service if I wasn't ready today. Well, it might be a short service anyway. I only got two pages, so it's usually three or four. However, this is the day you're going to want to listen carefully because it's going to get a little intricate, if you don't mind. Sometimes we can have some fun that way, getting into detail. But as this season approaches, it might be appropriate that we step back and look at the whole situation a little more carefully, and especially as we relate what we believe and what we do to other people. I'm sure the mainstream religious world is going to think us a little bit different in our practices and in our beliefs. And to a large part, it's over a particular way of worshiping. And it regards God's holy seasons and a different calendar that is used to identify exactly when those holy days are. The world's religions would regard such a thing as a minor component, if important at all. They see no relevance in these things to the redemptive process. The big issue with most, and it's valid to a point, is that all we need to do is love Jesus. Can't take issue with that. It is important. It is essential. But it's not an issue of love is all you need. You know, there's that famous song about that. Well, works to a point. But God gave us something to illustrate what He is doing. He gave us something to illustrate the steps involved in the redemptive process. So the holy occasions that God has given to His called out ones is important because it illustrates, it pictures what He is doing. And what He is doing revolves around the issue of harvests. Anyone who observes these days is going to realize that harvests are a major factor in each of these observances. They revolve around harvests. These observances that God gave us are a teaching tool. They help us to understand the plan. Religion, for the most part, has a general sense of the plan, but not to the degree that can be known if we follow, if we observe, if we pay attention to the things that are in His Word regarding these holy days that He has set for His people to observe, to learn of His ways. Anyone wanting to keep God's holy days, notice right away that those days are not illustrated on the commonly used calendar. For example, the Feast of Trumpets is on the first day of the seventh month. The seventh month is August? July? Okay. So obviously right there, we got a problem. The secular calendar does not give us those occasions. We have to rely on a different calendar, and that's where the world would think this is odd. God's holy days are related to the lunar calendar, not the solar calendar. And there's a big difference. The solar calendar is 365 and a quarter days per year. The lunar calendar is not. On a lunar calendar, the new moon is what determines the first day of the month. If you look on a secular calendar, the new moon is all over the place. It's never, rarely, the first day of the month. The lunar calendar is different. It's made up of 12 lunar months, but the problem is a lunar month is only 29 and a half days. So 12 lunar months is 11 days short of a solar year. It creates a problem. And that's one of the first things that we notice about the lunar calendar, or what we could call the biblical calendar, the calendar that was in use in the time of Christ. We notice something right away. Things don't work out incrementally as we think they ought to. We have to make a judgment call. We have to somehow correlate between the lunar year and the solar year. Now, being 11 days short, that means that every third year on the average, you have to add a 13th month to keep the lunar calendar in sync with the solar calendar. And that's what has to be done. Now, as was mentioned, we've got a pending Holy Day season beginning roughly 5 weeks away from now. And that would be Passover, which begins Friday night, March 26th, a little early this year. But I want to talk about what we observe, why we observe them, and how we determine the days. They're not related on our secular calendar. We have to use a different calendar to determine the days that God has set for these holy occasions. There have been many methods used throughout history to determine that calendar. Some observe the new moon, and that certainly can be done. Some use a calculated new moon. People have been observing, you know, these new moons for millennia, and it gets to be a predictable pattern. So it's possible to calculate when the new moon will be, whether you can see it or not. Others use the astronomical new moon, that point in time when the earth, moon, and the sun are in straight alignment with one another. Some use postponements, others reject them for various reasons. And it's important to determine these new moons, or the new months, the beginning of each new month, from a Jerusalem perspective, not using local time. And why is that? Simply because Jerusalem is the worship center for the worship of God. Jerusalem considerations must be factored in. But there's this problem with the lunar calendar that I've mentioned. 12 lunar months is about 11 days short of a 365-day year. That leaves us having to decide which months require, or which years require, the addition of a 13th lunar month. It's called intercalation, and it's done, like I say, roughly a third of the time. It has to be done to keep the calendars in sync with one another, to keep the lunar year in sync with the harvest seasons, because those are determined more by the solar seasons, not so much the lunar. So we have to make a judgment call. How do we determine which years we need to intercalate? And it happens about 7 out of every 19 years it has to be done. What is called a leap year of a sort. Now, here's where God's word begins to factor in. How do we determine which month should be the first month? Now, you'll notice on the holy day calendars that the first day of the new year jumps around in a range of several days, a month or more. It's not the same every year. How do we know in which month or in which year we insert that extra month? Well, God told Moses how to do that. Now, we need to remember that harvest seasons are variable. You can have dry years, you can have warm years, you can have seasonal adjustments that shift the time when the harvest is ready. And the harvest being ready is key to what God has given His people to understand. His holy days are all related to harvest seasons. And there's a message in that, because He is harvesting something Himself, and we should know what that is. But which month should be the first month? Well, in Exodus 12, verse 2, there was an unusual instruction. And this was new to Moses. God wasn't telling him something he already knew. This was something new. Exodus 12, verse 2. And the Lord spake unto Moses and Aaron in the land of Egypt, saying, This month shall be unto you the beginning of months. It shall be the first month of the year to you. Didn't they already know that? I'm suggesting no, they didn't. Now let's keep in mind here, the calendar, or the idea of a calendar, or the observance of a calendar of the harvest seasons, was not new to Moses. There had been a calendar for 2,500 years before the time of Moses. They knew when to plant so that the harvest would come in the right season where they wouldn't lose their crop. They knew what a week was from the time of creation. Adam knew about the Sabbath, the seventh day, from the very beginning. That was probably one of the first things that God taught him about, the Sabbath day. That's when God would come down and commune with Adam, on the Sabbath day. So they knew what a week was. They knew what a month was. The moon would tell them that every month. They knew what a year was. They could observe for many, many generations the annual cycles of planting and harvesting and winter. Nothing new to them. What was new here was God told them when and how to begin the new year. Now there's some carryover even in secular calendars. The new year used to begin in the spring. Even the Roman calendar, you know, September, October, November, December, that's 7, 8, 9, and 10. December, decem, is 10 in Latin, used to be the 10th month, which means the 12th month was February, which means the first month was after February at some point. So even the ancient calendars reflect somewhat the ancient belief that the new year began in the spring, not in the middle of winter. So there's some residue there, but that was the instruction that God gave to Moses, how to begin the new year. But there was an important component, and it's one that's overlooked pretty much, even in our own belief system. And that is, the determining factor was a strange little thing called the Abib. What is the Abib? The first month is named that. The Abib is the first ripe barley. What the ancients would do is in the early spring, they would go out and assess their fields of barley a couple of weeks before what they think might be the first month, they would assess that grain, and they would determine, is this grain going to be ready by the Passover season? Will it be ready for harvest? And if they determined that it was not quite ready, those were the years, then they would insert that extra 13th month. They would effectively postpone the start of the new year until that grain was ready. Why would it matter? Because it's tied to the harvest. That new grain was called the first fruits. The first fruits. Something very important in God's plan. In fact, you'll see in Revelation chapter 14, mention of the first fruits unto God. It all has to do with the harvest. Now, from the first fruits, they would count 50 days to Pentecost, also known as the Feast of First Fruits. That whole spring holy day season was relevant to, or related to, or focused upon the first annual harvest. The Abib was important. It was important to God. It's the Abib that identifies the first month. The readiness of that harvest was important to the beginning of God's holy day seasons. And it was the Abib that set the calendar for the rest of the year and gave us the dates for all of the other holy days. Like I say, if the Abib didn't appear to be sufficiently ready, they would postpone the start of the year to be sure that it was by the time that this important occasion came about. And that occasion was the waving of the wave sheaf offering. The wave sheaf offering was waved on the day after a weekly Sabbath, a particular weekly Sabbath. The weekly Sabbath that fell within the 7 days of unleavened bread. On that day, the priest would take a sheaf of the first ripe grain and wave it as a formal ceremony to be accepted by the offerer. The Abib is a little more important than we might think. We might just think of it as an indicator of when to set the first month of the year. We're going to learn a little more about the Abib here in a few minutes. But the readiness of the harvest was very important to God's plan. We today don't practice this Abib event. The reason being, Christ is our Abib. He was already presented and accepted for us on the morning after his resurrection, which happened to be the morrow after the weekly Sabbath. Most of us know that. There are people today who do monitor the first ripe barley over in the Jerusalem area. Usually they're about the same as our calendar. Sometimes they differ for whatever reason. But the wave sheaf is essential to another important event, and that is Pentecost, the count to Pentecost. Pentecost is another harvest festival, as are all of the days of unleavened bread, beginning to ending. We'll talk about that in a minute. The days of unleavened bread are to commemorate a spiritual exercise, that being coming out of sin, represented by spiritual Egypt. The days of unleavened bread represent to us at least, what we could call a growing season. We're to be growing in grace and knowledge. We're to use that time to focus on becoming more Christ-like, making us ready for our harvest experience. We have a part in God's harvest. He is to harvest us, hopefully as His first fruits, for His family and His kingdom. A prerequisite to our being part of that harvest is that we exhibit unleavenedness, which represents Christ's righteousness. Not only are we to put leaven out of our houses, it's a training, it's a learning experience. You learn a lot doing that. You learn a lot about yourself. Putting sin out of our lives. But not just putting out. The more important aspect is taking in the unleavened nature of our Savior. Now, I mentioned before that the wave sheaf must be accepted for us. In Leviticus 23:11, that's made clear. Leviticus 23:11. I'm going to start in verse 10. Speak unto the children of Israel, and say unto them, when you become into the land which I give you, and shall reap the harvest thereof, then you shall bring a sheaf of the first fruits of your harvest unto the priest, and he shall wave the sheaf before the Lord to be accepted for you. On the morrow after the Sabbath, the priest shall wave it. It is to be waved to be accepted for us. That wave sheaf is for us. And who was the wave sheaf? It was Christ. The wave sheaf was not just a formal ceremony. It had meaning. It represents a vital step in the redemptive process. Without Christ being accepted for each of us individually, we have little hope in being included in His harvest. The wave sheaf offering is not tied to any set calendar date for a reason. It draws our attention to detail. The wave sheaf is the first fruit. Pentecost celebrates the completion of the first fruits season. And yet there's another harvest to come after that, a later season, one that occurs well after this first smaller harvest. We have two harvest seasons, which is another important component of understanding God's plan for mankind. There is a smaller harvest first, the harvest of first fruits. And the name alone implies that there is another harvest to come, which includes a greater number of people to be harvested for God's family kind. Pentecost celebrates the completion of the first fruits season. But you can't know when Pentecost is without the wave sheaf. The first fruits are to have a special place in God's kingdom. We can read that in Revelation 14, verse 4, which shows the first fruits standing with Christ at that time, obviously having experienced the first resurrection and made spirit beings by then. Now, the New Testament seems to be relatively silent about the matter of the Abib and the wave sheaf. Doesn't say a lot about it, does it? Can you think of a place that talks about those things? What relevance, then, would it have if it's not in the New Testament? Well, in fact, it is there. And it's there big time. For those who understand, for those who have a sense of what God is doing, for those who realize the illustration in God's holy day plan, there is a reference, a major reference, that talks about this particular offering, the wave sheaf offering. It's found in Luke chapter 6. It's actually in each of the synoptic gospels. It's in Mark 2, Luke 6, and Matthew 12. Mark 2 is pretty much a reiteration of what you see in Luke 6, so we'll just stick with Luke 6, verses 1 to 5, and Matthew 12, 1 to 8. Now you would say, what does this have to do with the wave sheaf offering? Seems to have nothing. People look at this, and there's been many, many explanations as to what this is talking about. Most churches will say, oh, this is an example of where Christ broke the Sabbath. That's the explanation that you'll get. And when you realize what this is really talking about, they couldn't have missed the mark any further with that idea. This is not talking about breaking the Sabbath. I'm going to read the passage here and then we'll talk about it. Luke 6. A well-worn passage, one that couldn't be any more misunderstood, I think, than it could be. I don't know. Let's see. And it came to pass on the second Sabbath after the first that he went through the cornfields, and his disciples plucked the ears of corn and did eat, rubbing them in their hands. And certain of the Pharisees said unto them, why do you do that which is not lawful to do on the Sabbath days? And Jesus answering them said, have you not read so much as this, what David did when himself was an hungered, and they which were with him, how he went into the house of God and did take and eat of the showbread, and gave also to them that were with him, which it is not lawful to eat but for the priests alone. And he said unto them, that the Son of Man is Lord of the Sabbath. What's that got to do with anything? What's that got to do with this message? Well, as we'll see, it has everything to do with it. First, let's get a little overview of Luke chapter 6. This is very early in Jesus' ministry. In fact, it was probably, and very certainly, the first spring holy day season in his ministry. In Luke chapter 1, we see Jesus' birth narrative. In Luke chapter 2, we see described Jesus' infancy. In Luke 3, Jesus' baptism. In Luke 4, Jesus' temptations. In Luke 5, he's seen calling his disciples and performing some early miracles. So this we know, that by the time we get to chapter 6, this is very early in his ministry. In chapter 6, he announces his lordship and his ultimate purpose. It's there, but it's not obvious to everyone who reads that. I'll explain. This was probably in the spring of 27 AD. His ministry, 3.5 year ministry, began in the fall of 26 and ended in the spring of 30. But notice here, and Christ picked it up right away, that the Pharisees watching this field made a double accusation. Did you notice that? Now, next Wednesday, you could go across the street and rob that convenience store over there. If you did, you'd be breaking the law. If you did it today, you'd be breaking two laws, two infractions, because robbing convenience stores is not a valid Sabbath activity, last I looked. Okay? Double accusation. They were doing something that was, they said, unlawful, on the Sabbath. Double accusation. Christ gave them a double answer, if you notice. He gave the example of David and the showbread. And he also mentioned the fact of he being the Lord of the Sabbath. And that's what trips people up. They take that to mean that he is lording it over the Sabbath. He has more authority than the Sabbath does. So it's valid to break the Sabbath. That wasn't his point. What he was telling them is, when he said, I am the Lord of the Sabbath, when those people were trying to keep the Sabbath day in worship of the Creator God, whom they worshiped as Lord, he is saying to them, that's me. Okay, I am that Lord. Read it carefully, how it's worded. Now, they didn't pick up on that. The way he worded it, they didn't necessarily pick up on that. The thought may have entered their mind. But there's a double accusation and a double answer. But what was unlawful? It's not unlawful to pull an apple off a tree and eat it on the Sabbath day. It's not unlawful to take a handful of grain, especially if you're hungry, which these guys were, and, you know, rub it in your hands and eat a handful of grain. Not unlawful at all. Why would they say it was unlawful? And another interesting question, why were they watching that field? Why did it matter to them? Well, there was something going on. Now, there's that strange expression where it says, and it came to pass on the second Sabbath after the first. That's how the King James translators translated it. In the other, in Matthew 12, for example, it's called the second first Sabbath. What is the second first Sabbath? How do you identify that particular day? And it's telling us it's a particular day. It's not just any old Sabbath. It's the second first Sabbath. Well, that would imply that there is a first Sabbath. What is a first Sabbath? The first Sabbath is the first Sabbath from which you count seven Sabbaths to come to the day of Pentecost. So this first Sabbath is the Sabbath from which you begin the count to Pentecost. There was a first Sabbath, and there was a second first Sabbath. That was known in that day. So someone from the first century reading this would understand what it means. Now we know from Acts chapter 2 that talks about when the day of Pentecost was fully come, gives us a clue that there was more than one observance of Pentecost. One persuasion counted it one way, and one persuasion counted it another. There was actually a third first Sabbath, but that's a message for another time. But these two first Sabbaths didn't usually, in fact, they rarely would coincide. The first Sabbath was the Pharisean persuasion, which counted the first day of unleavened bread as being that Sabbath from which you count to Pentecost. The Sadducean persuasion took the Sabbath that fell within the 7 days of unleavened bread as the Sabbath from which you determine the 50-day count to Pentecost. So there was a difference. There was a first Sabbath, and there was a second first Sabbath. Now this occasion occurred on that second first Sabbath. So the Sabbath here would be the one that was the weekly Sabbath that fell during the days of unleavened bread, as opposed to the Pharisean first Sabbath, which would have been the first day of unleavened bread. And they always count the Pentecost from the morrow after the first day of unleavened bread, which brings them to Sivan 6 every year. And that tradition is continued to this day among Jewish people. This is an endorsement of the Sadducean count. Counting from the weekly Sabbath that falls within the 7 days of unleavened bread. That's what our practice is. We count to Pentecost from the Sabbath that falls within the 7 days of unleavened bread. The weekly Sabbath, not the annual Sabbath. Sometimes they can coincide, but not too often. But that's the thing that we need to realize. This is talking about that. But back to the question, why were the Pharisees watching that field? Why did they even care? Why did they think it illegal to touch that field, to take a handful of grain? I mean, why would it matter? Because that field was the temple ceremony field. They had to guard it so that no one would touch it. Remember what Christ said to Mary? Touch me not, for I have not yet ascended to my Father. He was the wave sheaf. He was first resurrected at that moment. And he could not be touched until he was waved before the Father. He was later that morning. Mid-morning, which is the traditional time for the wave sheaf. He ascended to the Father and was accepted for us. And at that point, it became possible that we could become first fruits also. So it was important that that field not be touched. And that was the lawful, the unlawful thing that they were being accused of. Because it was, to them, unlawful to touch the wave sheaf field until the wave sheaf was taken. You see what's going on here? He was teaching his disciples. Now, this was the first spring holy day season in his ministry. He had just selected his disciples. This was a lesson. He was taking them to that field, and I'm sure revealing to them that he was their wave sheaf. Just as he was revealing to them that he was the Lord of the Sabbath. He was the Lord that that Sabbath is looking forward to, or that reflects upon. That's the important lesson here. Now, let's go over to Matthew 12, because that has got one important little detail in it that is generally overlooked. But it is so startlingly important. Matthew 12, the first few verses. It's an account of the same thing, but it's got a detail in it that the other gospel writers didn't include. I'm going to start in verse 1. At that time, Jesus went on the Sabbath day through the corn, and his disciples were hungered and began to pluck the ears of corn to eat. But when the Pharisees saw it, they said unto him, Behold, your disciples do that which is not lawful. It doesn't say he was doing it himself. But your disciples do that which is not lawful to do upon the Sabbath day. See the double accusation there? They're doing something unlawful, and they're doing it on the Sabbath besides. But he said unto them, Have you not read what David did when he was anhungered, and they that were with him? How he entered into the house of God and did eat the showbread, which was not lawful for them to eat. It was just bread, but it was ceremonial bread. It wasn't lawful for them to eat, neither for them which were with him, but only for the priests. Or have you not read, here's the second rebuttal, or have you not read in the law how that on the Sabbath day the priests in the temple profane the Sabbath and are blameless? Answer to the second accusation. But look at verse 6. But I say unto you that in this place is one greater than the temple. What was he telling them? And what did they think he meant? Now you got to realize how sensitive the Jewish people were to their temple and their worship. He's saying there is one here greater than the temple. There's a bunch of Pharisees. What did they think he was saying? What was there? This tells us what was there. The wave sheaf was still there in that field. They thought he was referring to the physical grain wave sheaf. In reality, he was referring to himself. Now, why wouldn't the Pharisees react negatively to the idea that the wave sheaf was greater than the temple? Well, the wave sheaf had been around a lot longer than the temple. The wave sheaf preempted the temple. The wave sheaf had been practiced from the time of Israel's entrance into the Promised Land, long before even Solomon's temple, let alone the one that existed then. He was saying that he was that wave sheaf. But they didn't get it. We can get it, but they didn't. Otherwise, there would have been stones flying in the air, knowing how Jews react to such things. Happened before. Look at the time when he announced publicly that he was their Messiah. He had to duck out of the crowd to avoid being stoned to death. They reacted rather badly to such things. They would have here if they knew what he meant. But that little statement tells us two things. Number one, that he was their wave sheaf to come. It's a couple of years, two or three years off yet. But he was their wave sheaf. And it tells us, and we can tell that by the Jews' reaction, that wave sheaf was still there in that field. This was the wave sheaf field that they were violating. But for a reason. Christ was giving his disciples an important lesson. In this place is one greater than the temple. How does the temple relate to your salvation? How does the wave sheaf relate to your salvation? Which is greater? So the wave sheaf offering is very important. It's shown here to be important. We're given an endorsement of the alternate determination of when the wave sheaf was to be offered. The method used or the time used by the Sadducean persuasion, not the Pharisees. This little passage tells us a great deal. So hopefully from now on we'll understand what it's talking about. I've heard many explanations of trying to fathom what second first Sabbath means, or the second Sabbath after the first, or all kinds of ideas, but I think that's the most simple. There are two insignificant first Sabbaths. One comes before the other. There's a first Sabbath, and there's a second first Sabbath. And those two lead to different counts as to determine when Pentecost should be. So I hope this is helpful. These days are coming. We're going to be doing certain things. We're going to be observing certain things. And I think it's important that we realize what it is we're doing and why we're doing it. But let's not minimize the significance of this particular occasion, this particular observance, the waving of the wave sheaf before God in heaven for us that happened so many years ago. I want to conclude with some verses here. I'll just read them to you. This one is Revelation 12, 21, verse 6. And he said unto me, "It is done. I am Alpha and Omega, the beginning and the end. I will give unto him that is athirst of the fountain of the water of life freely. He that overcometh shall inherit all things. And I will be his God, and he shall be my son. Now, overcoming involves victory over sin. Something that makes, that gives us a unique relationship with our Creator. Skipping ahead into Revelation 22, verse 12. And behold, I come quickly, and my reward is with me to give every man according as his work shall be. And the first work being the attainment of the unleavened condition that is expected of God's called out ones. Verse 13, I am Alpha and Omega, he says it again, the beginning and the end, the first and the last. Blessed are they that do his commandments, that they may have right to the tree of life and may enter in through the gates into the city. Down to verse 16, and I, Jesus, have sent mine angel to testify unto you these things in the churches. I am the root and offspring of David and the bright and morning star. And the Spirit and the bride say, come. And let him that hears say, come. And let him that is athirst come. And whosoever will, let him take the water of life freely.